Hello everyone, this is New Books in Human Rights. As you know, every week we pick a book on human rights and host a discussion with its author. Today's guest is Ratri Chandra, an associate professor at University of Delhi with her new book, Knowledge as Property, Issues and the Moral Grounding of Intellectual Property Rights. The book came out in 2010 from Oxford University Press. When we talk of property, we usually mean property over tangible things like a car, a pen, or a house. However, since last 300 years, it has become incredibly important to think of property also as ownership of intangible things like ideas and knowledge. This has developed especially since the advent of the Industrial Revolution in England, when even people like Charles Dickens were concerned over the free circulation of books by English authors abroad. So the regime of protecting authorship and intellectual property was developed in England first, and then it spread internationally. This development, however, was followed by critique, especially by the critique from Global South, about the exclusionary and monopolizing nature of the regime of intellectual property protection. Nevertheless, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the basic international human rights document, contains two articles protecting both the right to private property as well as the right to intellectual property. Ratri Chandra's book asks very important questions in relation to intellectual property. First of all, whether it's fair and justified to think of moral grounding of intellectual property in the same way as we think of moral justifications for owning private property. And then whether both the right to private property and the right to intellectual property should be considered as human rights, as basic entitlements to which each of us is entitled. And then, what are the distributional consequences of the regime of intellectual property protection? I will let Ratri answer these questions in the interview.
Good morning, Ratri.
Morning, Anna.
Good morning. It's such a great pleasure to have you here, and I thank you in advance for the time that you found to talk with us.
Thank you.
Ratri Chandra is a scholar and a mentor from India. She's a professor at the University of Delhi. And today we will talk about her new book, Knowledge as Property, Issues in the Moral Grounding of Intellectual Property Rights, which came out from the Oxford University Press recently. Congratulations on that, Ratri, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you, Anna.
Yes. It's. I hope we will be able to unfold as many issues as you are able to cover in that book. It's a very well-researched book. I learned a lot as someone that doesn't know much about intellectual property rights. So I hope that we are able to cover those in the conversation. But before we move to the book, Ratri, could you explain a little bit, how did you arrive at the topic? How did you become to be concerned with intellectual property?
Yeah, you know, much before I actually began to think and write about this work, I was actually, as an appalled Indian, as an appalled member of the Global South, already watching the developments that ensued in our parts of the world post-1995, which is when the TRIPS regime, the WTO TRIPS regime, came into play. And I began actually following some of the news reports and the writings and activisms of, activists like Vandana Shiva, who runs this research foundation for science, technology, and ecology, Suman Sahai, who heads the Gene Campaign Program here in Delhi, Martin Kaur of Third World Network, and so on. And they were all talking about focusing on the one-way flow of genetic resources and exploitation of not just genetic resources of the Global South, but also of the indigenous communities and their knowledge systems. They were talking about the lack of benefit sharing mechanisms. They were talking about issues related to the global commons. Who do the commons belong to? Are they global, which translates into free access for transnational corporations? Are they community owned? Or do nations have a sovereign right over their own biological resources? So these were some of the issues that were kind of being tackled in their writings. Simultaneously, what also was happening were a number of patent challenges which were going on in the U.S. Patent and Trade Office and the European Trade and Patent Office against the patenting of traditional plant varieties and traditional medicines and traditional therapeutic things, which were very much in the public domain, which were probably as old as history. And I'm here referring to the patent claims which were made on neem, turmeric, basmati, all three actually very, very traditional crops and of India. So there were three interesting cases. If you want, I can briefly refer to them of how, you know, what got this entire issue into the forefront.
Yes, go ahead. Absolutely. That would be very interesting.
So in June 19, now W.R. Grace and Company are a U.S.-based transnational who had claimed a patent on neem in both Europe as well as in the U.S., in many European countries. In 1995, Vandana Shiva, along with, and very interestingly, along with Linda Bullard of the International Federation of Organic Agriculture Movements from Germany, and Magda Alboet of the Health and Environment Minister of Belgium, they filed and won a patent challenge in the European Patent Office on grounds that the use of neem was as old as history, and that the patent on neem was not novel, and the patent lacked novelty and inventive step. Again in 1995, and in some senses the mid-90s were really, really, years of turmoil and ferment, so to say. So in 1995, again, there was a patent challenge by 200 NGOs from 40 countries against the W.R. Grace neem patent. And this was headed by both Vandana Shiva and Jeremy Rifkin's. 1997, you have the turmeric patent challenge in U.S. by CSR India. In 1997, there were two very, very interesting cases, one in South Africa and 2001 in Brazil. Both the governments were actually trying to reform their internal health laws relating to access and pricing of medicines, to actually source antiretroviral medicines, parallel import generic ARV medicines from India and from other countries. In South Africa, this was resisted by 39 pharmaceutical companies, and they challenged this piece of sovereign national legislation, stating that it was in contravention to the TRIPS regime. Eventually, they withdrew the complaint because of strong international pressure and mounting public opinion. 2001, Brazil was a similar story, where Brazil wanted to enhance its generic drug capacity and allow the parallel importing of generic drugs by invoking a national emergency and by invoking the compulsory licensing provision in TRIPS. Now, the U.S. complained at the WTO, again stating that what the Brazilian government was doing was in contravention to TRIPS. It eventually again withdrew, thanks to, you know, the global mounting pressures. Now, these examples I have cited simply to kind of let you in on the climate of indignation that was building up, you know, in the global south, and how to us intellectual property rights over pharmaceuticals, over plant varieties, over indigenous knowledge systems were beginning to seem as extremely immoral and unethical. And spurred by this, I began to see connections with political theory. I began to develop my own kind of thesis on this and began to see intellectual property as a right and wanted to question its claim as a, you know, as a right, its moral claim as a right. Wanted to see if it makes the claim, because after all, it is claimed and contested from a rights perspective, and therefore the underground, the normative claims to a right should be there. That's the reason I began to kind of explore normativity as a criteria for intellectual property rights. And that's how I began working in this area.
Yes, and thank you so much. And if I'm not mistaken, was this your PhD dissertation?
Yes. This was my PhD dissertation, yeah.
Excellent. So just before we go into detail, into sort of exploring your claims and your arguments, for those of us that are not so familiar with intellectual property, and to me that seems to be like a property right over knowledge, which is a bit different than a property right over some tangible things like my car or a house, right? So if you could lead us through sort of the concept of intellectual property and basic tenets of it.
Yeah. I'll really simplify some of the basic terms, and at the risk of oversimplification, just stating that intellectual property rights are not a monolithic concept. It's an umbrella term for various kinds of entitlements which attach to certain types of information, ideas, or other intangibles in their expressed form, in their manifested form. So the holder of the intellectual property right receives various exclusive rights over his intellectual production or creativity. For instance, a copyright holder would get get exclusive rights to reproduce, perform, and prepare derivative works over his literary or artistic creation. So copyrights typically are extended to original material in literary, artistic, dramatic, musical works, films, broadcasts, multimedia, computer programs, etc. The second type of IPR would be patents, which are granted for any device, substance, method, or process which are new, inventive, and useful. These are the three criteria for patentability: novelty, inventiveness, and utility. Now, typically, patents grant monopoly rights to patent holders over a period of 20 years. During these 20 years, the patent holder would have exclusive right to not use, but to license and downstream the use of his patented invention. All right. What they don't cover are laws of nature and abstract phenomena, but what they do cover is an extremely, extremely wide range of things, which can cover manifested forms of ideas, industrial inventions, pharmaceuticals, plant varieties, so on.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from this, there are the older forms of intellectual property rights, which are trade secrets, which are typically over certain secret formulations, trademarks, which are over symbols and certain identifying characteristics of a particular trade practice. The most recent entrant into the domain of intellectual property rights are what is known as geographical indications, which basically attach themselves to products which are originating from a particular region in a manner that they carry the cultural and the regional stamp of that place. So, for example, champagne, Parma ham, Kanchipuram saris, these would be typical examples of geographical intervention. Indications, I'm sorry. So these are broadly the five kinds of intellectual property rights, repeating them again: copyrights, patents, trademarks, trade secrets, geographical indicators.
Excellent. Yeah. So how has the process of transforming knowledge into property, how has that process unfolded historically? I think that's very interesting to find out, because today it's kind of customary to think of copyright, as I understand, when one writes something, then one understands himself or herself as an author, the work is copyrighted. But initially, this was a particular form of expressing knowledge or ideas, right? So what was the historical process which led to sort of our common understanding of knowledge as intellectual property?
Yeah. There are two pieces of legislation, actually, two conventions which can be held to be precursors of modern IP protection. One was the Statute of Anne in 1624, and the other Statute of Monopolies in 1709. The Statute of Anne related itself to, and both together kind of lay the foundation for copyrights, patents, and trade secrets. This was in the 17th and the 18th century, and these laid the foundations for, the development of copyright and patent regimes. What happened were expansions and enhancements of certain provision in both these statutes, and by 1800s, international commerce expanded a great deal in the post-industrial revolution period. And a number of British authors, including Charles Dickens, began to complain of widespread piracy of British books abroad. Thus grew a demand for an international codification of regulatory copyright practices. At the same time, scientists, inventors, especially German inventors, raised similar concerns about their inventions being copied in foreign countries. Now, these concerns and demands culminated in the Paris Convention in 1883, which protected industrial and technological innovations, and in the Bern Convention in 1886, which was for the protection of literary and artistic works. Since then, there have been several revisions. One of the most central ones has been the revision in 1967, which led to the formation of the WIPO, World Intellectual Property Organization, to promote and administer intellectual property. However, even at this stage, intellectual property as a regime did not occupy center stage in the field of rights or in economic theory and practice. It was pretty much a bilateral arrangement between certain developed countries, namely Europe and the US, and also a bilateral agreement which was between countries of roughly the same development capabilities. What happened in the 20th century were development, and what kind of brought about the paradigmatic change, in a sense, were the development of new technology like xerography and electronic information technology in the mid-20th century. Now, this brought certain new things into play. For instance, copying became far easier. For instance, relaying and sharing of copied material became much easier. And this kind of created a newfound nervousness amongst both authors as well as inventors, as well as technological experts and scientists. And various enactments were then took place in both Europe and US, which finally culminated in the Uruguay round of the GATT negotiations, which ushered in a new era of multilateral trade policy. And TRIPS was one of the outcomes of this Uruguay round. TRIPS is trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, which basically tries to bring all intellectual property regimes under one universal global protection regime for intellectual property protection. Basically, an expansion on the Paris and Bern Convention, TRIPS, but there is a big fundamental difference here. TRIPS is far more prescriptive. It is more universalistic and definitely more exclusionary. And this has had deep implications for changes in the conception of property itself. Not only who is the property holder, but also in what can count as property. A very interesting fact actually is the change in the vocabulary in the language that begins to be used in the 18th and 19th century. The terms that were used were monopolies, and in the 20th century and 21st century, you see lawyers and policymakers increasingly replacing the term monopoly with property, which conveys the impression that these are after all similar to interests in land or houses or cars, and they should be accorded similar protection. So broadly, this is the history of how property came to be propertized, in a sense.
And when you were listing the challenges to certain patent claims, I couldn't help noticing that they emanate from the countries which are termed as emerging economies: India, Brazil, South Africa. So one question I had, as this international body of law developed in relation to intellectual property, was there any resistance from emerging economies or the South or activists in terms of how this international laws were formulated, and what were the primary concerns or criticisms in this process, if you could elaborate on that?
In 1995, when the TRIPS regime came into being, and the developed countries were given a window, some of them were given 10 years to kind of bring their intellectual property regimes in consonance with with the international regime. So in 1995, although countries like India become signatories to the WTO and consequently to TRIPS, they do not automatically were required to offer full protection in 1995. It was only in 2005 that they become fully TRIPS compliant, so to say. Now, between 1995 and 2005, there were a number of misgivings, number of protests which took place, but and typically they kind of converged around issues of, say, patent challenges, about the invocation of compulsory licensing to source generic drugs. However, there was no concerted global movement to resist. Because the individual governments themselves had become signatories by then. So in a sense, the government was not speaking in the same language as the activists in these third world countries, particularly health, particularly issues relating to access to medicines became one of the focal points of global movements where Brazil, South Africa, India, Thailand, these countries were coming together because these are also the countries facing extremely severe and challenging, you know, health concerns. So pharmaceutical patents actually began to be seen as a big, big problem. And a lot of global networking began to happen around pharmaceutical patents.
And at the same time, so intellectual property has become to be understood as a human right. Which one, if one is coming from sort of liberal tradition of human rights, could understand as a very positive thing for individual development or individual happiness. So how can you lead us to the way to how has intellectual property become to be understood as a human right, as an individual entitlement, as a claim, as something to which each and every human being is entitled?
Let me kind of rephrase this a bit, because I have problems in considering intellectual property as a human right. I see intellectual property more as economic entitlements, as a reward in the form of monopoly rights over innovation. Although I agree with you that in the UDHR and International Convention of Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, there is a mention of intellectual property as a human right, but the focus is entirely different from the way TRIPS the WTO understands it. You know, even in UDHR and International Convention of Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, references to intellectual property are more in the nature of individual and people's rights to preserve traditional knowledge. Then secondly, on the right of everyone to enjoy the benefits of scientific progress and its application, the right of everyone to enjoy the benefits of intellectual production. So from both moral and material, benefit from the moral and material interests of authors and inventors. So both in UDHR and International Convention of Economic, Cultural and Social Rights, there is an acknowledgement of both individual and cultural rights, collective rights of communities over their knowledge systems, as well as individuals' rights over their innovative activity. However, the WTO policies rarely factor in human rights consideration. So they do not see a consonance, or they do not see an intersection between the economic entitlement of individual innovators or authors and human rights consideration. In fact, compliance to WTO at times mandates that these regimes rely primarily on economic considerations and not on human rights considerations. So it's a kind of a mixed bag. If you say that intellectual property is a human right, you are at the same time trying to obfuscate, kind of override some of the underlying contradictions between IP rights and human rights themselves. So I'd say knowledge is a human right, but definitely not intellectual property as a human right.
That's very interesting, and also shows how, and it has been also highlighted in some other literature, how the two regimes, sort of two worlds, the human rights world and the WTO, the trade world, are kind of separated and divorced from each other. So another question that I had, and which I think boils down to your central argument in your book. So you explain in your book what are the traditional sort of more accepted moral groundings for property rights. Mm-hmm. And then you argue that these should not automatically apply to other to entities which are not tangibles, because intellectual property is different by its nature. So before we move to your central argument, could you explain us to us what you consider as the sort of main justifications, main moral groundings for right to property?
Yeah, let me kind of just explain the fundamental difference between old forms of property, which were tangibles, both movable and immovable, like cars and pencils, pens, and immovables like land and house. Let me just distinguish between old tangible forms of property and new intangible forms of property, and then I'll try to demonstrate how the earlier principles of legitimation do not hold good for new forms of property over intangibles or over biological forms of property. Now, the fundamental difference between the two is that property rights over tangibles were created to resolve problems of scarcity. So you had a world of scarce resources, and property rights were created to resolve problems of appropriation, allocation, and distribution. Now, hello?
Hello, yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, the second category of property, which is over ideas and intangibles, is paradigmatically different category of property, because, interestingly, it does not exhibit the same identifying characteristics as old property, because of two main reasons. One, that it is not plagued, that the world of ideas, the world of knowledge, is not plagued by the problem of scarcity. There is an infinite source of ideas. Use of ideas do not lead to its exhaustion. All right. So the first defining characteristic of the world of ideas is that they are infinite and they are characterized by non-exhaustion. The second interesting characteristic, which again makes it fundamentally different from tangible forms of property, is that ideas can be used concurrently. For example, if you are singing your song and I copy your song, it does not divest you of your use of the song. If I stole your car, you would no longer be able to drive that car. But if I stole your song, it does not you can still use your song, you can still sing your song, you can still sell your song, right? Mm-hmm. So non-exhaustion and concurrent use, these two properties of intangibles like ideas and knowledge, make it fundamentally different. And therefore, property rights were not implied naturally, so to say, in this realm. Because this was a realm which was not scarce, property rights were not implied naturally. Therefore, a law was made to step in and create an artificial scarcity by preventing a free flow of ideas, if you get what I mean. You know, so the free flow of ideas, disclosures, sharing of knowledge, sharing of ideas, were curbed through patents, readers' rights, copyrights, and so on. So this was the fundamental difference. Now, what are the two main principles of legitimation that I have identified in my book? One is the principle of self-ownership. Now, self-ownership is a very, very powerful way of expressing sovereignty over your own self. So self-ownership says that I own myself, and therefore, as the owner of myself, I also own the talents and skill that I own. Therefore, and this is a typical Lockean argument, an argument that John Locke uses to justify liberty as well as right to property, absolute rights in liberty and property. And he says that because I own my knowledge, and this is something which is echoed even in Nozick, where he says that you know, men have freehold in themselves. So, you know, you hold yourself as a property and you own all the talents and skills that you have. Therefore, Locke says, and again echoed by a neo-Lockean Nozick, that anything that I create using my talents, using my skills, is mine to own as well. All right? So if I use my labor to create a pot, if I use my labor to till land, then that land is mine, that pot is mine to own. Right? Now, Locke argues, and as does Nozick, that property rights were actually an extension of the principle of liberty. So property rights were a variant. You extend liberty rights. If a man truly wanted to be free, then he ought to be given complete property, absolute property rights in what in whatever he created. This was also echoed in Kant, who says that freedom requires separate property. Now, what the second principle that I allude to, so this became a justification for private property, self-ownership. I own myself, therefore I own whatever I create with my self-owned labor. The second principle of legitimation was utility, which is basically that in a world of scarce resources, I need to have property rights, rules which define who ought to get what property, rules of allocation, rules of appropriation, rules of distribution. So it's a system which actually creates wealth, as Adam Smith would say, or a system which actually maximizes utility, as Jeremy Bentham would say. Now, my argument is one of the two main arguments in this book is when you translate these two principles to the realm of intellectual property, they do not hold good. And one of my motivations for doing this was to actually adopt a very minimalistic perspective, not question property rights, not question absolute property rights, but actually to see if the principles of legitimation hold good for intellectual property rights. And as I conclude, they do not. And evacuate intellectual property rights of the very premises on which it rests. That was my motivation. Now, why do they not rest? Should I, the first is the principle of self-ownership. Now, if self-ownership is primarily a tool or is primarily a principle which celebrates and protects the liberty of individuals, which is considered to be inviolable in liberal philosophy, then my argument is that intellectual property rights only protect and celebrate the liberty of the creator, of the person who is awarded the intellectual property right. Mm-hmm. So if I hold the patent, my liberty is protected because I'm the patent holder and I'm free to use my invention in any way that I want. However, if you simultaneously, either through the process of copying, and let's forget copying, if you simultaneously invent something and you probably are 2 hours late in claiming that patent, then you are not granted that right over your invention. So your labor is actually not rewarded. You are divested of your liberty over the property that you have created. Do I make myself clear, Anna?
Absolutely. Very clear and very understandable. Yes.
Yes. So so when self-ownership is kind of translated to apply to intellectual property rights, there is a fundamental contradiction, because intellectual property rights are basically contravening the like liberty of others, a non-negotiable proviso in both Locke and Nozick. Mm-hmm. All right? So it contravenes, forget about social democratic welfarist norms, it contravenes minimalistic libertarian norms which seek to protect liberty. All right? So my first argument or my first conclusion is that self-ownership, cannot be applied to, I mean, look at history. History is replete with examples. James Watt was granted a patent over the steam engine. Now, James Watt and Hornblower, who had independently designed the Hornblower engine, had to face legal challenges from James Watt. James Watt died a rich man, and Hornblower had to close shop and died in jail. Look at Wright brothers. So history is replete with examples of simultaneous invention, but only the person who's recognized as the inventor is the one who's rewarded, is the one who's accorded property rights. And the person who's not the first knower, who falls back because of certain circumstances, people like Tesla, people like Popov, lose out in the process. So the claim of the first knower is discriminatory. It discriminates against like liberties of the others. So the second principle that I think is one of the central legitimating principles of property rights, especially intangible resources, is the principle of utility. And recall that I said that utility fundamentally, the principle of utility fundamentally argues, or the propounders of the principle of utility fundamentally argue, that private property rights help to organize society and organize production much better. Private property rights help to allocate. Hello?
Yes, I'm here. Yes, I'm listening. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So private property rights help to allocate, distribute resources in the most efficient and most productive manner. When I transfer this principle to see if it holds good for intellectual property rights, I find there is again a problem. Now, I have taken utility to mean not just economic utility, so not just efficiency, productivity, and so on, but also social utility. And I've tried to argue that the common good argument doesn't hold good for IPRs because there are huge social costs that are incurred. And some of the important ones are, for example, because of patenting, there are higher transaction costs which are incurred. There are multiple licensing agreements which have to be entered into. Patent sanction monopoly rights and therefore mandate, and therefore also sanction monopoly prices and reduced access to resources. Patents diminish the public domain, forests, seeds, etc. And it is extremely problematic to assert that intellectual property rights can find legitimation in the principle of utility, because utility fundamentally is any utilitarian would do a fundamental cost-benefit analysis. And this cost-benefit analysis has to factor in costs that are incurred by the society in terms of the social costs, in terms of the health costs, in terms of the reduced access costs, in terms of all the other costs that are non-economic as well. And therefore, an integrated utilitarian argument, expanded notion of utility would definitely lead us to conclude that the number of costs that are incurred in by the intellectual property rights regime is far, far higher than the gains to the economic gains to the private property, intellectual property holders. Yeah, and it especially targets the vulnerable and the poor communities. The social costs are especially borne by the poor, vulnerable communities of the world. So these two principles, both self-ownership and there are many, many principles, but these are the two central principles of property which have endured and which have also found expression in intellectual property justifications.
Very interesting. And what I notice here is when you discuss, and it's also, there's an extensive chapter in your book about sort of your discussion and your take on the idea of knowledge and sociology of knowledge. And here also when you discuss your move from sort of moral grounding in property to intellectual property, I see that there's a particular theory of knowledge that sort of is at the background, right? You discussed the knowledge as an inexhaustible resource. So could you sort of explicate a little bit on what is your theory of knowledge that underlines this work?
I do not have a distinct theory of knowledge which is separate from the sociology of knowledge school of thought. And I do to adhere to the fact that knowledge is something which is essentially socially constructed and socially constituted, and ideas are not something that exist out there independent of societies, independent of histories. Ideas are socially determined. And this was the sociology of knowledge, that knowledge was socially constructed, was first and foremost kind of propounded by Karl Mannheim. And this position was later reinvented by Luckman and Berger to suggest that knowledge is not just socially constructed. Knowledge is not just a passive thing which the society is constituting, But in the process of being constituted, knowledge is also constituting reality. So there is a dialectical relationship, not just knowledge being a product, but knowledge being a determinant of reality as well. So knowledge and reality in a dialectical relationship with each other. Now, this position was further refined by people like McCarthy Doyle and others, who move from the social constituency of knowledge and focus on the function of knowledge. And here, because they regard knowledge as fundamentally a capacity for action, and here they focus on both the productive as well as the ideological function of knowledge. Productive, because it gives you the capacity to create. For example, if I am a professor, my knowledge gives me the capacity to earn, so therefore it's a product. Therefore, knowledge is performing a productive function. It helps to allocate and distribute resources. Now, knowledge also, and this is an important part of what McCarthy Doyle says, that knowledge also performs a ideological function because it is a structuring discourse. It creates hierarchy, it decides who the knowledge holder is, it decides what constitutes knowledge, it decides what is scientificity, it decides, it adjudicates on what is objectivity, which knowledge is true, which knowledge is false. So therefore, it kind of creates hierarchies of knowledge. And in creating hierarchies of knowledge, it also performs an ideological function because there is a distribution of power to the holders of knowledge and a taking away of power from the people who have been designated as holders of either irrational, unscientific, or folk knowledge, or belief, and such like. So knowledge performs a dual function. Now, there's a fourth aspect actually to sociology of knowledge, which is basically not just contesting sociological knowledge, knowledge of the society, knowledge of the human world, but also contesting that scientific knowledge is objective. And that scientific knowledge basically is an aggregation of facts, and that facts cannot be contested, and that it is sort of trans-historical, trans-spatial, and that knowledge, only true knowledge is one that is objective. Now, this was the positivist conception of knowledge, which held that the only knowledge which is worth being considered as true knowledge is scientific knowledge. Beginning with Thomas Kuhn, who asserted the historicity of science, where he asserted that science is relative to history and therefore is not as immutable or as objective or as epistemologically unique as it is made out to. And now several others actually have promote what is called the strong program in sociology. People like H.M. Collins, Barry Barnes, Stephen Shaping, David Bloor, focus on the social dimension of scientific practice, not just sociological knowledge, not just knowledge of the society and the human world, but on the sociology of scientific knowledge as well. Science itself by them is considered to be an interpretative act. So, one of their core and central conclusions would be that scientific facts are both socially and cognitively institutionalized. And there's a very interesting a thing that I read in McCarthy Doyle's book, which, critiquing the objectivity of fact, she states, and I quote, that facts are like cows. You stare at them hard and they run away. Here she's trying to suggest that facts are also, not immutable, not transcendental kind of entities which cannot be contested. Facts are also created. Facts are also interpretative facts. So sociology of knowledge, why I brought sociology of knowledge and sociology of scientific knowledge into this book was to suggest the contextual, historical, intergenerational knowledge of character of knowledge, and to argue that because knowledge is contextual, because knowledge is historical, therefore to lay individual claims on creation of knowledge is faulty, is a problematic premise.
It's very interesting. So it's like mummifying something that shouldn't be mummified because it's always in the process of transcendence.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. Yeah. And in relation to your discussion of science, there's a particular concept which I would appreciate if you would elaborate, and that's the concept of science citizenship. And you argue in the book that existing regime of intellectual property rights sort of doesn't support integration of marginalized groups in the scientific processes, as I understand. So I would appreciate, since we are expected to be listened to by the scholarly community, I would appreciate if you would elaborate on that concept in particular.
Yeah, the issue of science and citizenship is actually linked to the issue of intellectual property rights as power. And closed systems of knowledge like the intellectual property rights regime actually restrict disclosure and free flow of information. And because they are restrictive, they are actually, because they are restrictive, because they are partial, because they are taking sides, because they are classifying knowledge into what is scientific and unscientific, they are all, you know, what gets, as Foucault said, what constitutes knowledge and what is excluded, who is designated as a qualified knower, always involves an act of power. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue of citizenship is linked to contesting the hierarchies of power, the hierarchies of the knowing and the knowledgeable that a regime like IPR has created. It is trying to contest particular views of science and technology, which gets embedded into global networks, institutions, and policy and legal frameworks. What began as a contestation around issues of biopiracy has kind of moved on and incorporated a demand for traditional resource rights, for community property rights, access and benefit sharing mechanism, farmers' rights, all rights that are collective in nature. So while particular views of science, while particular views of knowledge actually limit citizenship, there is also a parallel movement which is trying to gain induction into the setup. At what cost the induction is going to happen, at what cost the integration is going to happen is another question. But there are issues of collective rights which are constantly being posed to the intellectual property rights regime, to the TRIPS regime. And fundamentally, when you question particular universalistic notions of science, objectivity, and knowledge, there is also an assertion at the same time of plural collective notions of knowledge, that there is a plurality of knowledge, that knowledge is essentially collective in nature, and contesting of universal notions of knowledge. This is what claims of citizenship are actually, people who are trying to claim integration with the system are trying to do. Mm-hmm. So it is being framed around principles of reasonable pluralism, collective rights, and so on. You know, there's a long way to go because currently the kind of rights that have been accorded to collectives are in the nature of access and benefit sharing mechanisms, farmers' rights, to name two of them. Now, these are rights which are actually stripped to the bare minimum so as to kind of enable the intellectual property rights to, you know, function well. These are more in the nature of neoliberal spaces of governmentality rather than, you know, a fair democratic principles of citizenship that are being adhered to. Yeah.
Very interesting. And there's a particular theory of rights which emanates from your book, and which I think is your very serious contribution to the field of human rights, on my very humble opinion, but it's because I found very interesting. And that theory states that basically for the rights to be legitimate claims, they have to be in relation, in a dialogue with other rights. So you cannot take an isolated human right and then hold strong upon it unless it's in a constant relationship and engagement with other rights. That's my sort of my take on your thesis. But what I would appreciate if you could explain is, first of all, that theory of rights, and then how does that relate to the moral grounding, moral justification of intellectual property rights?
Yeah. The first argument, which I've already kind of outlined, is that property rights need to have strong normative grounds to justify them, because property rights at the end are exclusionary in nature. They are exclusionary in nature. And I have tried to say that even on normative grounds, even on minimalistic grounds of liberty, property rights, intellectual property rights cannot be defended because they are not consistent with liberty claims of other people. Now, the second argument is that if there are not good enough normative grounds for intellectual property rights, then they should at least have good consequences.
Mm-hmm.
They should at least be judged for the consequences they generate, and consequences which are not just economic, but which are rights sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
So how well do rights, intellectual property rights, conjoin with human rights, other rights of other people? How well are they in a conversation or in a dialogue with other human rights becomes an additional ground to claim or disclaim rights. All right. So if your right is stepping on my toe, then your right has a weaker claim than if your right is in a kind of dialogue or if it conjoins with my right. So yes, I agree that rights have to be in dialogue with each other, and rights which infringe or abrogate other rights have weaker claim than rights that do not. So in that sense, compossibility of rights becomes a necessary condition for claiming legitimacy. And in my book, I take three rights, which are all aspects of human rights. I take health rights, farmers' rights, and knowledge rights. And I've explicated each one of these rights through a case study. I have tried to argue that intellectual property rights infringe on health rights because they push up the prices of drugs, because drugs are at monopoly prices, as much as 10 to 20 times, sometimes even more higher than generic drugs, which leads to reduced access. The reduced access is a contravention of health rights of many, many people. Access to medicine is vital to the preservation of the right to health, and that is what intellectual property rights or patents infringe upon. The second right that I've taken is the farmers' rights, and here I've taken an example actually from U.S., of McFarland versus Monsanto, where McFarland was sued because he did not pay Monsanto the license fee for the seeds that he saved. So the traditional right to save seeds, which is almost considered as a natural right of a farmer, is being taken away from him because that right, that patent right, has been granted to a company like a corporation like Monsanto. You can argue that the right to save seeds is a natural right of the farmer, and these rights are taken away as IPRs in agriculture actually facilitate control over seeds at the expense of small and marginal farmers' ability to save and replant seeds. So it reduces access of farmers to seeds, and apart from that, apart from restricting saving and replanting, seed control also weakens the genetic pool of open pollinated seed varieties, creates monoculture. So there are a lot of issues here which are linked to issues of livelihood of small and marginal farmers, because biodiversity, after all, is also an issue of, can also be linked to issues of livelihood of small farmers. So again, I argue that intellectual property rights are infringe upon farmers' rights, and especially in the developing world, especially in least developed countries, in the LDCs, small and marginal farmers become very, very vulnerable when they are caught in the market nexus of sourcing seeds for their fields. The third right that I take is knowledge rights. And here I have referred to, hello?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just keep saying,
Yeah.
Human right that I've taken is our knowledge rights. And I've referred to two contestations, which I've referred to earlier also in this talk, by Vandana Shiva, two NEEM patent claims, one in the US patent office and the other in the European patent office. Referred to other examples as well, like basmati, turmeric, ayahuasca, maca, enola beans. The South has been an endless source of agricultural and pharmaceutical genetic material. And there are innumerable examples of appropriation of traditional knowledge by way of patents which are granted on derived application. Now, this is in complete contravention to what ought to be regarded as sovereign rights of the traditional communities over their resources, over their practices of knowledge. So these are the three sort of case studies that I have taken to demonstrate that IPRs are not in dialogue with human rights, and that there is, on grounds of human rights, it is very, very difficult to justify intellectual property rights.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting, and perhaps my final question, based on what I understood from your book and your narrative. So it seems to be a very rare and very insightful critique of intellectual property rights and the moral grounding and their moral groundings. So I'm thinking whether you also, as the author, understand your book as such contribution to the field, and where do you think your manuscript stands in relation to the mainstream literature on intellectual property?
There are a number of books, there are a number of writings, articles, which actually critique intellectual property rights from a consequentialist perspective, that is, in terms of the outcomes they generate. Mm-hmm. So whether it is from the perspective of activists, whether it is from the perspective of global administrative law, there is a critique of intellectual property rights which is happening. But at the same time, most of these critiques are actually at the same time also trying to fine-tune the system of intellectual property rights so as to enable the regime to address certain human rights issues. But in the process, what is happening is that human rights are kind of trimmed and stripped down to their bare minimum so that they fit in with the larger regime, with the larger interest of intellectual property IPR regime, which is to create value for the innovators. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, where I think my book would make a contribution is because I think I derive morality both from deontological normative grounds as well as from consequentialist grounds. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to suggest that there is a moral problem whether you examine the deontological grounds of normativity or whether you examine the consequentialist grounds. There is a problem with the fundamental idea of regarding knowledge as property itself. No matter how much you fine-tune the larger machinery, eventually it will have snags, eventually it will step on toes, eventually it will leave the vulnerable communities more vulnerable, because it is a system which is fundamentally within its soul probably unethical.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time and for your willingness to talk to us. That was a real pleasure.
And thank you, Anna. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
This is Anna Tolidze on New Books in Human Rights. As you know, every week we pick a book on human rights and have a discussion with its author. Today our guest was Rajshree Chandra with her excellent book, Knowledge is Property, Issues and the Moral Grounding of Intellectual Property Rights. This is New Books in Human Rights. Hope to have you here next week.